Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 3 of New Scientist May the 4th. This is getting rather interesting because I read the editorial about this. This is Amber. Fossil supplies mean that there's scientific money going into blood conflicts. These are like blood diamonds. And it's also very interesting to see these things stored in amber. It's pretty amazing to watch it. You see the wings and everything. Blood amber, a trove of exquisitely preserved fossils, is changing what we know about the age of the dinosaurs, but getting hold of them may mean fueling a bloody war, Graham Lawton investigates. You have to remind yourself that you are looking at an animal that lived alongside the dinosaurs. In my hands is a piece of amber. I hold it up to the window and get a good view of the tiny corpse inside. A spider, legs splayed out behind its body. It looks like it died yesterday, but it's been mummified for almost 100 million years. Under the watchful eye of curator Claire McLeish, I pick up another piece of reddish translucent amber, stuffed with full of insects. She tells me that 1 in 7 slices of the most fossil-rich piece of amber ever found, a fist-sized nodule containing 454 different species. It's 1 of the 7 slices. I'm at the Natural History Museum in London. Behind the scenes, look at the Burmese amber. Until recently, a cache of 117 pieces were collected when Burma, now known as Myanmar, was part of the British Empire. This was the only research collection in the world. But as the past decade or so, the scientific interest has exploded. Burmese amber is one of the world's hottest paleontological treasures, crammed with fossils from the crucial and hitherto quite opaque time window is yielded in vertebrates, plants, flowers, mushrooms, birds, snakes, frogs, and even dinosaurs. It's an entire tropical ecosystem, says Ed Jarzembowski, the amber expert at the Nanjing Institute of Geology and Paleontology in China, who happened to be visiting the museum that day. But he also tells me it's now a war zone. I came here to marvel at the paleontology local cornucopia. I live for the darker story of ethnic hatred, smuggling, environmental destruction, diabolical work conditions, and a bloodshed. Burmese amber, or Burmite, has been prized gemstone for centuries. The entire world supply comes from Kachin, the northernmost state of Myanmar. The richest deposits are all found in a remote jungle valley called Hawang, which the Burmese for Place of the Devil. The name is apt. For almost 70 years since Myanmar's independence of the UK, Kachin has been a no-go area. The ethnic minority, the Kachin people, have been struggling for independence since 1962. Right now, the situation is very tense. Quote, you don't go into the Kachin, there's a war on and it's getting hotter, says Jarzan Benuiski. Amber starts out resin, which uses one of the conifers and trees of species in response to injury and attack. Small animals often get trapped in the goo, along with feathers, leaves, and fungi. Very occasionally, resin fossilizes and becomes amber. When heated and compressed after being buried under sediment, a viscous and volatile gum polymerizes and hardens into a form resembling perspex. And now it's interesting, amber is the term, perspex is the term, electra is for electricity, is amber. And electricity is electrons, perspex. Yep, okay. Now, what's the ebonite? Oh, I think ebonite's negative chatter. I'll have to really, really concentrate. It shows you the ancient world in photographic detail. They don't look any different to how they would have been alive. Fossils in amber, known as inclusions, are windows to the long-lost ecosystem. Baltic amber, for example, dates back 44 million years to a time when Europe was subtropical archipelago. Found primarily around the Baltic Sea, the amber contains the most diverse fossil assemblage in the world, with more than 3,000 species. These build a vivid picture of a steamy oak and pine forest with lakes, rivers abuzz with flying insects and crawling with geckos, spiders, and mantises, termites, scorpions, and stick insects. Bulk amber is durable and transparent, and so ideal for scientific studies. Other ambers are less so. On my visits to the museum, I saw samples from Mexico, US, Dominican Republic, elsewhere. Most look like boring brown pebbles. Burmese amber, however, is glassy and translucent, making it another invaluable window into the past, albeit one that took a long time to open. The amber first came to scientific attention in 1892 when Fritz Nöcklin, a German employee of the Geological Survey in India, was on the lookout for exploitable resources in British Burma. He noted the amber was stuffed full of insects and other inclusions and reckoned it was about 40 million years old, roughly the same age as Baltic amber. In comparison with on Baltic amber, which can easily be mined in large quantities and frequently washes up on beaches, Bernese amber was in the middle of a hostile jungle. If Nöcklin and his ambitions to exploit the deposit, they were had ambitions they quickly waned. A few years later, a local amateur naturalist called R.C.J. Swinehoe started sending samples to entomologist Theodore Cockerell at the University of Colorado. Cockerell identified 38 new species of insects, three arachnids, and a millipede, and reported that there were many more he couldn't identify. The fauna is very remarkable, he wrote in 1922 later to the journal Nature. Based on the fossils, he suggested that the amber was older than he originally thought, possibly 100 million years old. If so, it would make it very interesting. In the early 20th century, the fossil record of insects in the late Cretaceous between 166 million years ago was all but non-existent. It was a frustrating gap given the flowering plants were new on the scene and evolution explosion was in full boom. In 1921, Swinehoe donated the collection to the British Museum. It was the only such collection in the world, but for some reason it got filed away and forgotten. Then came Jurassic Park. The plot of the 1993 movie hinges on extracting dinosaur DNA from 300 million year old mosquito preserved in amber. On the back of that, the museum decided it needed a paleoentomologist to look at the collection, says Melish. Isn't that lovely? So the museum comes out. The go-to guy was Alex Rastalin of the Paleontology Institute of Moscow. He visited London and quickly added to the roll of colored species, identifying spiders, a scorpion, a small snail, and some reptile skin. Around the same time, Ketchin Independence Organization and its military wing, Ketchin Independence Army, KIA, killed in action, signed a peace treaty with Myanmar government. Soon afterwards, the owner of the small Canadian mining company called Leeward Capital went to Chechen in search of riches and ended up in the Hakoin Valley. Amber was Leeward's plan C after A, gold, and B, platinum failed to pan out. Plan C went badly at first. The world market was flooded with Baltic amber, so the company sent samples to David Gilmer at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He reported amazed and brought 3.6 tons of raw amber. Chinese scientists soon got into the act. The Burmese amber rush was on. Over the next few years, interest ballooned. According to Andrew Ross of the National Museum of Scotland, the number of pieces described with Burmese amber has grown exponentially. Species. In 2000, there were 60. In 2018, another 320 were added. The last count, there was a total of 1,192 in total. Well, it's not exponential growth as far as I can see. The deposit has also been dated using modern isotopic techniques and placed it at 98.8 million years old, or plus or minus half a million years. Most of the fossil insects and other small bugs there are, but there are larger organisms too. Among the invertebrates are crabs, scorpions, cockroaches, armored spiders, dragonflies, millipedes, a snail, a hairy cicada, grasshopper, and a mite wrapped in spider silk. One piece contains a spider attacking a wasp, a rare example of fossilized behavior. There are plants, including flowers, that act an act of releasing pollen. They are preserved, all are preserved exclusively. There are also marine animals, including an ammonite, a shrimp, suggesting the forest where the amber formed was by the sea. Most thrilling of all are the vertebrates. Scrapes of reptile skins, isolated feathers, were already known in the Natural History Museum collection. But the past 2 years, a breathtaking menagerie of animals has been discovered. In 2016, a team led by Grammarly unveiled a collection of 12 lizards. A few weeks later, a rival group described two tiny wings from hatchling birds, which presumably tumbled out of their nest and got stuck in the resin. Next came part of a trail of small feathered dinosaurs, complete with skins, bones, and plumage. And the past year has been a rush of vertebrate fossils, a hand of a gecko, two entire juvenile birds, four frogs, and a snake. The fossils appear to be formed in a tropical forest on the coast dominated by redwood trees, which produce prolific amounts of resin. Stuck in time. At this moment, it's the best glimpse we can get to the Middle Cretaceous, said Ryan McKellar of the Royal Shetland Museum in Regina, Canada, who co-wrote the papers announcing dinosaurs and snake ferns, among others. There's gaps in the fossil sedimentary rock. Burmese ambers help fill the gap. It helps us understand things like how flowering plants rose to dominance, how insects diversified alongside them. But this understanding comes at a heavy price. Spend any time delving into Burmese amber literature and you'll soon hit a frustrating information fog. The papers are often hazy, if not totally silent, about exactly where the findings come from. The reason is a lot to do with the uncertain and often controversial provenance of the specimens. Today, Burmese amber has a long and treacherous journey before ending up as gemstones or museum pieces. After being mined by hand at the Hawkwind Valley, it's laboriously transported out of the disputed territory to a bustling market on the outskirts of Mitikanya, the capital of Kachin. See the map 43. Most of the amber is bought by dealers from the neighbouring Chinese province Yuhan. From there, it's smuggled over the border to a bazaar in the city of Taichung, which is a magnet for dealers from Beijing. Shanghai and Jiangsu used to specialize in jade, but increasingly dominated by amber. In 2017, the Chinese government named Taichung the City of Amber. What I learned in my research is that virtually all the amber is imported to China without going through customs on either side, says Alessandro Ripa of the Center for Asian Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, who visited Taichung and Michiantka to research the amber trade. The scientists who have visited Taichung are united in their awe. I've never seen anything like it, says Jazem Borowski. There's stall after stall of amber, and you know everything you're looking at is an undescribed species. It's spectacular, agrees McClure, who visited last year. I had no idea the scope until seeing it in person. There are 4 to 5 streets of amber vendors, dozens and dozens of people selling it by the kilogram. It's mind-blowing. Many of the pieces are huge, the size of a human head, he says, suggesting that even more spectacular discoveries may be coming. We don't face the same size of limitations that we do for other amber deposits. There's potential to get whole animals. Most of the amber is destined for the gemstone markets, but some end up in researchers' hands. Scientists don't routinely scour the markets themselves, but know people who do. At any point along the pipeline of the mine to the market, savvy dealers will be pulling interesting-looking specimens from one side and offering them to potential buyers of the scientific world. The linchpin in the operation is a paleontologist called Li Da Xing of China University of Geosciences in Beijing. In recent years, he built up a network of amber dealers in Chaching and Yuhan who tips them off when something interesting crops up. They will send photos, videos, and photos from all angles with details. If I feel there is scientific value, I'll recommend these museums to buy, as Ying told the New Scientist by email. One of the best account systems is Desu Institute of Paleontology, a not-for-profit museum in Chazhou, China. Since it was established in 2013, it has bought more than 150 important Burmese amber fossils, including a dinosaur tail, which has unloaned to the scientists like McCullough. Desert website says, tantalizingly, that we also have other equally important but not yet published amber papers, specimens. The Chinese Academy of Science has also poured money into buying the Burmese amber, says Jan Zemberski. His institute has 30,000 pieces. McKellar, who is visiting fellow at DESSU, says that it and similar institutes are doing a great service by ensuring scientifically important specimens end up with researchers rather than vanishing into private collections. But he accepts that they often don't know exactly where the fossils come from. If you buy material, you've lost control over stratigraphy or where the specimens are in the geological record. Very occasionally, however, scientists do know exactly, but finding out takes a lot of effort and bravery. In the summer of 2015, Zing met a contact in the market of Michigana. The man showed Zing a piece of polished amber about the size and shape of a dried apricot, containing what appeared to be a plant stem. Zing examined it with a handle and realized it was something much more interesting, a section of vertebrate tail complete with feathers. Oh my god, China, India, Laos. Poor Burma. He bought the piece on behalf of DESSU, and although he won't say how much for, the latter showed it to McKellar. It turned out to be from a feathered dinosaur, probably a juvenile pteropod. I was blown away by this sort of thing, and we'd hoped to find, McKellar told the Canadian radio station in 2016. Zing had previously tried and failed to get to the amber mines. Now he was even more determined. A few days later, as he pulled off a seemingly impossible, smuggling himself from Michiana into the Hawang Valley. The trip was an arduous and risky. In 1994, a ceasefire between the KI and the AI military, officially called the Tut Mat Dor, had collapsed. In 2011, the hostilities had resumed. Mines were now under the control of the KI, whom the gemstones are an important source of revenue. A transboundary road opened a few years ago, making it easy to get from China to back China, but crossing into KI territory is a different story. Travelling on forged papers and in disguise, he wore local clothing and smeared his face with yellow pigment used by the Ketchin as a sunblock and insect repellent. Xing and his contact drove for 7 hours on nearly impassable roads through numerous army checkpoints. When they ran out of road, they crossed the river on a wooden boat and then covered the final few kilometres by elephant. Well, in Xing's account, the mine turned out to be a shanty town around 3,000 tents, each covering a narrow mine shaft about 10 metres deep. The miners were living in bamboo huts along among the shafts. Zing described the issues of mines very, very dangerous and humane. The miners' work had no safety equipment and often die of suffocation or collapses. After 3 hours collecting ambers and rock samples, he and his guide left, making the grueling return journey. While he was there, Zing said he met dealers who had sold the dinosaur tail to his contact and was taken to the mine shaft it came from. He says he was able to confirm the precise origin of the Permes amber fossil, giving his contacts, of course. Jing also says he was satisfied that he obtained its specimen legally and that it was exported into China with a permit issued by the appropriate authority, the Mayo Gems Enterprise. All Jews Burmese amber specimens are obtained legally, he says, New Scientist, as has tried to confirm this directly with DESSU and hasn't had a response. Buying Burmese amber inevitably raises ethical issues. Since hostilities resumed in 2011, the amber mines in the Hawang Valley have been the centre of an increasingly bloody resource war. The extraction independent organisation heavily relies on natural resources, mostly jade and gold, but also amber, for its revenues. It also taxes those using the smuggling routes into China. As the territory is de facto government, it uses the funds for schools, hospitals, infrastructure, says Han Hinstrom, a senior campaigner, a Myanmar resources expert, an NGO global witness. The independence organisation doesn't publish any figures about the revenues and spending, she says, but it undoubtedly also uses the money to buy weapons. The Tut Mat Dor, which is a ceasefire, also craves control of the mines and smuggling routes, both to squeeze the chicken independence organisation and to keep its spoils for itself. According to the Global Witness and other NGOs, its generals have a long and ruthless history of making personal fortunes from jade and natural resources. And that is the reason why an equitable peace is so hard to broker. Soon after the ceasefire was broken, the Tapmadaw was at it again. The Jade Rani areas were attacked and controlled by the Burmese army from 2013 to 2015, says Stephen Teshi, head of the coalition of civil society organisation called the Kachin Development Network Group. The KRI made up for the loss by expanding its Amber operation, he says, but Myanmar army came for those two. Last year, the UN Human Rights Council sent an independent fact-finding mission to Kachin to document the conflict. Its report makes gruesome reading. In June 2017, the Myanmar Air Force dropped leaflets onto the Amber mines warning locals to leave the area within 10 days. It then launched a military offensive. For the next 5 months, the Tamil subjected the villagers to an indiscriminate campaign of murder, torture, rape and arson. The fencing stopped during the rainy season, but resumed in 2018, with aerial bombardment supported by, oh, this is awful, by heavy artillery and ground troops. The UN reports that Chapmel's overall objective was to destroy the KR's economy by appropriating AMA and other mining resources under their control. According to Tajik, this mission succeeded. In the UN's conclusions, the damaging, the military operations are illegal under international law, and Myanmar's commander-in-chief, senior general Min Aung Hlaing, and top military leaders should be investigated and prosecuted for genocide crimes against humanity and war crimes. The Amber mines are also a cesspit of human rights and environmental abuses. Poor working conditions are pretty much the trademark of all mines in the Kachin state, and environmental regulations that exist are largely ignored. Amber is only part of the resource war, and scientists are far from the only people buying it. But it's impossible not to conclude that they are complicit, if not actively involved in the trade that helps fund the war. Quote, I think the money coming from China has fueled the conflict indirectly, says Jarzembowski. We don't know for certain, but I wouldn't be surprised. There's a load of money. Research costs. Jutes and other collectors don't disclose how much they pay for specimens, and scientists, they say, don't know, although McKellar guesses a good vertebrate specimen would fetch in the order of $1,000. Jarzembowski also reckons thousands, and that the snake specimen was probably very expensive. The dealers are canny and play labs off against each other to inflate the prices, he says. While the Chinese Academy of Sciences will pay whatever it takes to secure important specimens. According to unsourced estimates published in the Canadian newspaper The Financial Sport, the dinosaur tail could easily fetch $100,000, and a legal amber trade is worth $1 billion a year. Arthur McKellar and his colleagues were aware of the conflict and the amber role in it. He paused and sighs, to some extent, it's a shame, but it's a sort of beyond our control. I don't see us directly fueling it. It has escalated over the past 3 or 4 years. A lot of the samples we are dealing with are collected before the problems in the region. For now, amber mines are under the control of the Tapmadaw, although Hinstom and other predict that the KLA will try to wrest them back. The peace process aimed at ending all of Myanmar's ethnic conflicts is underway, but the KRI has refused to participate. Already this year, 79 scientific papers have been published on the Burmese amber. The following specimens continues the rumours circulate of even more spectacular fossils. Ching Chong, the amber market, is busy as ever. One of the most prized stones on offer is the deep red colour known locally as Xupo, translated into English, blood amber. That's beautiful. It's Hollywood tale. Could we really extract 100-million-year-old dinosaur DNAs from a skids preserved in Permies and Jurassic Park? Sadly, almost certainly not. According to Claire Mellish of the National History Museum in London, insect fossils in Ava are hollowed out, exoskeletons with soft inners being longer decayed. Even if she should survive, DNA wouldn't. The half-life of DNA is something like 500 years, and we're talking about a system 99 million years old, says Ryan McKellar of the Royal Saskatchewan Museum in Regina, Canada. Even if the storyline of Jurassic Park is fanciful, the film's impact on paleontology has been very real. After the movie's success, institutions around the globe began taking a closer look at their amber collections and unearthing new finds. It's interesting about that, isn't it? Page 24. No, it's not page 24, 24 minutes in. the space wide web. Take billion years of racing to build an orbiting internet that is accessible anywhere on Earth, says Mark Harris, which is going to be rather interesting, because how are you going to police that? You know, the major thing is that you can see that the real money, I think the real money will be getting behind the Great Internet Wall of China. At Sharkin knew there was money to be made in the internet, so she took a spade into the woods near where she lived, about 50 kilometres outside the Georgian capital of Tbilisi. There, the 75-year-old hoped to dig up copper wiring to sell for scrap. Instead, she got through the fiber-optic scale, worthless to her, but priceless to millions of people in the neighbouring Armenia, left staring at black screens for 12 hours. She'd cut off the country's internet. The 2000... I don't know quite what that means. In 2011, the incident shows how easily this can happen to underground cables, and those underseas are even more vulnerable. Every few days, an earthquake in Anchor, a boat, damages roughly 430 seafloor cables. Tonga went offline for nearly 2 weeks in January after the underwater cable was cut. In some ways, an isolated island nation, Tonga, is lucky to have had this connection. The cost of laying cable to remote places means only about 10% of the planet's surface in terrestrial communication links. According to the UN, nearly half the world's population has never been online. To reach them, to ensure everyone has a reliable connection, billion years, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and Richard Branson plan to reinvent the internet, to free it from its earthly roots and build a wireless web above our heads. Balloons in the stratosphere, constellation of satellites, cruising drones, many are no sort of ideas. Pull this off, and humanity's greatest information repository will find a dazzling futuristic home. To make it work, we just need to deploy some old technology, albeit in a highly unusual way. The internet is a genetic network of computers. When you type an address into a browser, you are instructing it to connect to another machine that could be anywhere in the world. Most of the connections are via cables. Even smartphones don't use radio waves to connect just a few hundred metres to a cabled cell tower. But longer stretches are possible. Satellites internet today often uses relay stations far enough from the Earth that they remain in a steady geostationary orbit. As seen from the ground, they are a fixed position. Pinned 35,000 kilometres above the equator, they can serve as a wide swathe of land. But 70,000 kilometres around trip adds a drag of an extra half second or more to signals, and the annoyance that disrupts voice calls and makes multiplayer online gaming or high-speed financial trading impossible. On top of that, download speeds are slower than modern cable connections and subscriptions are pricier. The setup requires a large, distant, clear view of the sky. One alternative that tech companies have been recently considering is the stratosphere. From around 10 to 50 kilometres up, which is the ozone layer, this layer of atmosphere is high enough for a transmitter to surface the stars area below, yet low enough for it to communicate with it without the need for a receive dish. Better still, putting things in the stratosphere is easy to compared with space. Hungry for astronomers, Facebook and Google built prototype solar-powered drones that could loiter about 20 kilometres for weeks, beaming down the internet. In these projects that are now on hold following crashes and damage when landing the Featherlight aircraft, other companies, including Boeing and Airbus, are working on similar drones, but the technology is far from proven. Google's next idea is kookier still, a train of gracefully floating balloons, delivering data to those below. The balloons, which provide connectivity following the natural disasters of Peru and Puerto Rico, have been spun out into a company called Loon, and that plans to launch the commercial 4G network in Kenya soon. However, balloons are unlikely to do much in most of the offline billions, as many places lack reliable winds or convenient launching places. If you are a tech billionaire with a global vision, only a truly worldwide service will do. Luckily, there is a little way. What if you put transmitters lower than the lone geostationary orbits with their unpleasant lags, but higher than the stratosphere with its fickle weather? There is a price to be paid for using low Earth orbits. From the surface, satellites appear to zip from horizon to horizon in about 10 minutes. For continuous service, then you need multiple satellites flying quick succession over enveloping the globe, all sending signals from one another in a smooth relay. Firms Iridium, Globalstar and Orbicom each have a few dozen LEO satellites and they already offer basic slow internet services. Get the tech right and turning the limited services into something transformative becomes a numbers game. And if there's one thing tech billionaires think they do understand at scale, it's occurred to Bill Gates years ago in the 1990s. He backed the startup Teledisc, which envisioned a mega constellation of 840 low Earth orbits, relaying radio signals from one part of the Earth to another. The company had big plans to deliver affordable broadband to 95% of the world's surface. It never happened. Teledisc folded in 2002 without launching a working satellite, having neither developed the technology nor raised the billions of dollars required. But a fresh generation of billionaires are ready to try again, buoyed by the cheaper launch cost and the new, more powerful technologies. Take OneWeb, a company backed by Airbus and computer chip manufacturer Qualcomm and entrepreneur Richard Branson. It put the first six satellites, costing $6 million apiece, into orbit in February. The firm says 600 satellites connecting users to 40 or so ground stations should be on place, providing service by 2021. Yet OneWeb satellites only plug a gap in cable internet. The last leg of each data's packet journey is the user may be through space.
Oh. We're going 34 minutes.
But at other times, travels through the same wires as the rest of the internet. Other companies are trying something more ambitious. Traffic in the sky, so right. Elon Musk, SpaceX, Canadian company Telstar, and Luxembourg-based Leostar all plan to create end-to-end space-based internet systems for the early 2020s. Each of their fast-moving satellites must be available to communicate with others, and their respective networks relaying data in hops from one side of the world to the other. All three companies all have the same idea. Do it with lasers. Theoretically, lasers are a smarter way to communicate in space than radio waves. So that's what Kerry Kell of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They are more energy efficient, so transmitters and receivers don't need to be so large. Physically, size can be smaller with the lasers, which he says. Lasers also sidestep the issue of working within the increasingly crowded radio spectrum. Radio transmissions are highly regulated and frequencies would be most practical for smaller sizes already taken. In contrast, laser beams with their tight focus almost never cause interference in the surfaces and are likely regulated. They're also fast. Imagine a financial trader in London wanting to access the latest New York Stock Exchange. If her connection were routed through SpaceX's planned constellation of nearly 12,000 Starlink satellites, data might reach her in 45 milliseconds, according to calculations by computer scientist Mark Hadley at the University College of London. That's half the time currently takes by fibre optic orders at cable, an advantage that could be worth millions. SpaceX expects the laser internet to attract 40 million subscribers and 30 billion in revenue by 2015, with Starlink eventually helping to fund Musk's other dream, colonizing Mars. But lasers have their own problem. The main one is successfully pointing the beam with the thickness of human hair at another satellite speeding at 1,000 kilometers an hour.
I don't think it's right myself because it's got diffraction limited.
I think that's bizarre. So a human hair one must, the smaller you go, the more it diffracts out. Unless it's X-ray lasers. Still, it isn't totally virgin territory. As early as 2001, the European Space Agency established the first inter-satellite laser link between large satellites in low Earth and geostationary orbits. And in 2013, NASA used laser beams to beam a picture of the Mona Lisa from Earth to a spacecraft circling the moon. Kahoe is now working on a machine called Click, which will pack lasers capable of high-speed communication over hundreds of kilometers into satellites the size of a Rubik's Cube. These satellites will use wide-angle lasers as beacons to locate each other, then activate narrow beams for higher bandwidth link. NASA is due to launch two of them in 2020. Just the idea, and Mars could be using similar technology in Starlink. SpaceX already has two prototype lasers in orbit, although each is the size of a car. It plans to start deploying commercial satellites this month, the first of hundreds of launches ahead, years ahead. What I do think is that you can sort of create a very large focused laser by having it span out and controlling the phase of the individuals do it. So that's really interesting. Linking two satellites with lasers is one thing. Maintaining connections between thousands 24 hours a day is another entirely. Talking in satellites in front of you, behind you, in an orbital plane is actually pretty easy, it says. Or when you try to go from your plane across to another plane, that gets a little bit more challenging. SpaceX's planet-spanning constellation will feature crisscrossing orbital planes with satellites whizzing past each other at high speed. Choreographing the dance entails knowing exactly where each spacecraft is at any moment and where it's heading. And in an argument, in agreement this signed this year, the company asked NASA for technical support in choosing GPS hardware and running the agency orbital calculation software on Starlink's onboard processor. The company also plans to move more than 7,500 of its satellites orbiting to an altitude of just 340 kilometers, far lower than existing communication satellites. That will keep transmission delays to the bare minimum. This is blowing my mind. Reduce power needs. But also in subject satellites to increase drags and wisps of atmosphere. Without regularly firing their thrusters, satellites would be dragged down and burn up in weeks. Even so, Starlink expects it to last just 6 years or so before exhausting its propellant and heading earthward. To sustain its fleet, SpaceX would have to commit to a task of continually replacing satellites that re-enter the atmosphere, as many as five a day per after the first 6 years. An even bigger issue is how consumers will access LEO satellites, low Earth orbit satellites, from the ground. Although lasers are likely to operate at ISAF infrared frequencies, the beams would be blocked by even mild cloud cover. So all the LEO satellites projects are to use radio waves to communicate with the ground in orbit, which means using pricey steerable antennas. This skews any claims that the SpaceNet is going to get the poorest people online. This is media scholar Lisa Parks at MIT. Even pizza-sized receiver that Musk says SpaceNet is developing costs $100 and $300. This will be prohibitive for unconnected users in much of the world, while connecting the unconnected sounds good from the marketing perspective. There's little clear evidence that such a model can deliver profits to companies and investors. Yeah, this is towards the end of the tech boom. People begin to scrape the very bottom of the basket there. There's also, let's see how much time I've got here, 39 minutes, I'm getting really tired. There's also skepticism about how many users, which nations have an appetite for the additional gadgets and subscription plans. By the time any of these constellations is in the field, the ready supply of paying services to real customers is going to have 5G infrastructure in Western countries, and Africa is moving to 4G. Now, I think 5G is going to be incomprehensible. We're getting fibers now. It's going to be incomprehensible. I really wish I understood what 5G is. However, some think that wireless companies will welcome mega constellations as partners rather than rivals sharing satellite signals so that customers can access space internet from their phones without having to buy expensive antenna. Another potential benefit for those living in repressive countries is that satellite internet could theoretically exert censorship and measures as the Chinese Great Firewall. I think that's the main reason they would be doing it. It is unclear how that would play out, however, when Musk raised the possibility in 2015 suggesting SpaceX wouldn't service users in such countries. Any country would say it's illegal to have a ground link. He would say, we would conceivably continue to operate, but then they have a choice of do they shoot our satellites down or not. China can do that. Elsewhere, a space-based internet could be simpler, more reliable than accident-prone cables. Invisible beams of light are largely immune to hacking or tapping. If one or two satellites fail, replacements could quickly be launched. By getting into space, but betting on space lasers put an awful lot of eggs into one basket. A powerful solar storm or a cascade of satellite collisions, as depicted in the film Gravity, might be damaging or disable the entire constellation. However, in a world already dominated by a small number of tech firms, perhaps the most disturbing aspect of tomorrow's mega constellation will be having the power over such critical interstate concentrated in just a few hands. If you thought the story of Ashlyn Schulman's novel was worrying, imagine having a few powerful individuals control the space internet's off switch. I find this hard to understand. I'll come to the end of this magazine. Okay. This is feedback. Okay. I think this is a more satirical. I have a bit of a read. Size of them. With almost every corner of the earth now saturated with adverts, companies are advancing on the final frontier on getting us to notice their products. Elon Musk was the first to boldly go where no advertisers had gone before, sending a Tesla Roadster into orbit around the sun last year. Perhaps the Tesla car's autopilot function in an environment where there is few objects to collide with. Now, Russian company Starrocket plans to launch clusters of CubeSats to create a global orbital billboards by reflecting sunlights, forming shiny logos that would be visible in the sky at dawn and dusk. According to the film website Futurism, food and drink firm PepsiCo is planning to use the service to promote a campaign against stereotypes of unjustified prejudice against gamers on behalf of the energy drink called Adrenaline Rush. However, it appears that PepsiCo has since canned the project, fearing a public backlash. Our songs are among those pleased that the billboards won't go ahead. Feedback's inclined to agree, while wondering whether we have missed the valuable opportunity to test the hypothesis. There is no such thing as bad publicity. Astrology 2.0. New scientists were dismayed before given to thinking astrology like religion crashed and printed magazines would face a struggle to survive the 21st century economy. Not so. In fact, it's a $2.1 billion industry just waiting to be disrupted by digital technology. The New York Times reports that astrology has traded its psychedelic new wave stigma for modern Instagrammy witch vibes, and those vibes are very popular with millennial women. Spotting the opportunity to make money, venture capitalists have invested millions in apps like CoStar, which lets users compare their birth charts with those of their friends and enemies to help them understand conflicts. For those doubting the science behind them, CoStar's horoscopes are algorithmically generated with based on data from NASA. So that's all right then. It must be galling professional astrologers to be usurped by artificial intelligence, but they must have seen it coming. Okay, I don't know. News for the unenthused. News readers could be the next in line to lose their jobs to automation. Readers may recall the story of a dancing robot described as Russia 24 TV as the most advanced in the world, which turned out to be a man in a robot suit. The mishap has apparently not dented the Russians' immediate passion for technology. The same broadcaster has now employed a humanoid robot to read news following a high-level robotics conference. This time, there is no doubt, the droid in question was mechanical in nature. Nevertheless, the reaction of viewers less than existing. The other piece, I thought, actor Dmitry was stung by bees that then got drunk. It was a robot, horrible, wrote one viewer, quoted by the Daily Telegraph. The first few seconds provided a gag reflex. Its frozen gaze through the centuries like a drug addict's, another wrote. It feels like a dead thing with a new screen that feedback is watching stuck on a seemingly ever-living Brexit loop. It seems just the ticket. Okay. So let's read this. The back page. Okay, question and answer. Almost the last word. Can a blind person still benefit from a positive effect of natural life and circadian rhythms and mental well-being? I lost my remaining light perception 10 years ago since I've had insomnia. This would suggest that the answer by question is no. Maybe I need to get out more. The reader may have non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder, which is common in people who have no light perception whatsoever. In every cell of our body, there's molecular clocks that regulate the time pretty much at the same physical process from release of hormones, activities, immune cells. It runs roughly 24-hour schedule, although some people are closer to 23 and others to 25. The way in which we say synchronized 24-hour days is through signals of light sensitive cells in the back of the eyes called intrinsically photoreceptive retinal ganglion cells, which are not rod and cone cells, they're another cell. So they're not photoreceptors. They are photoreceptors, but they're not. When light hits those each morning, it acts like a reset button on the stopwatch. The brain adjusts its timing and signals the body's molecular clock to do the same. Some people who are blind, these cells are damaged and thus connection broken. As a result, they revert to the genetically determined time clipping. People with 23-hour clock would wake at 8 a.m. one morning, 7 a.m. the next, 6 a.m. the next. Because of this, they often experience insomnia. It's worth seeking advice of a certified sleep consultant, as melatonin supplements can be effective treatment if diagnosed. Some people who are blind still have benefit from sunshine to make vitamin D. There's also mounting evidence that sun exposure tweaks the immune cell activity and blood pressure, which also benefit our health. Canine connection. While quietly walking my small dog, we often pass a house where the dog inside, which is out of sight, begins to barking. How does the dog know to bark if it can't see or smell or hear us? I wouldn't assume that the barking dog is unable to smell the dog. Houses you are passing are hermetically sealed. Dogs can detect scent molecules at very low concentration in the air. Canine hearing is acute. My dog, Arby, knows the acoustic signature of a metal bowl. The ting of the most minute morsel dropped in the bowl brings Ashley rushing for it. You're probably not walking your dog as quietly. You think the dog can hear frequencies of up to around 60 kilohertz, which is far higher than our upper limit. So any high frequency noise you produce may be perceptible to you, but perfectly audible to the dog. Plus, some dogs can hear sound down to minus 15 decibels, much quieter and lower limit than humans, which is 0 decibels by definition. So even if you can't hear yourself walking, nearby dogs almost certainly can. Our dog, Alfie, can detect the host van from about 100 metres away demonstrating his hearing is very much better than the humans. What I can't work out is how he reliably detects my wife on her way home from work at a distance of 3 kilometres or more. Bearfields, UK. A dog's sense of smell is vastly superior to yours. Your approach may be detectable due to the dog inside when you are quite a distance away. Dog may also sense your footfalls through the ground as the sound of sensing waves will travel from outside to inside through any convenient conduit such as sewage pipes, electric wiring, or fibre cabling. I don't know, that's a bit weird to me. Dogs are also very time sensitive. If you walk at a similar time each day, the barker will be expecting you and your dog. So to be alert to it. My dog, Sparky, who's almost totally deaf, is still able to sense the movement of people and vehicles outside. He can distinguish different people's footsteps. Rarely barks, though, as he may well have become to presume that humans can't hear anything either. Dogs are pretty smart. Essentially, what is amazing is that they don't get annoyed with us who aren't. The behaviour of our Shih Tzu Rupert suggests that dogs' heightened senses are key to this. If I come up the lift at our apartment block and leave the lift talking to someone, he barks from behind the closed door 15 metres away. If I'm not talking, he doesn't bark. He will bark at either of our daughters arriving long before they have reached the door. But he never responds to anyone else coming out of the lift, so he must be highly sensitive and be responding specifically to sounds of my voice. He doesn't bark at visitors unless they come through the door and are strangers. And that finishes this magazine, and we'll stop it there. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.